Good afternoon on this sunny Friday. You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writer's Voices with Monica and Carolyn. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And your co-host
is Caroline Kilborn. And it's a beautiful day. It's only 9 degrees by the bank, but it feels much warmer because you're not in the wind.
Yeah, I'm not sure why. Yesterday felt really cold to me, and today it doesn't feel as cold.
Well, the sun's shining, and, you know, if you're out of the wind, it's quite pleasant.
Well, before we get to our wonderful guest today, we want to mention a little, again, the guest that we had last week who is teaching a workshop. Carolyn, you want to fill us in on that?
Yes, I will. So you may still register for the Writing Through Loss Workshop, sponsored by Hospice of Washington County and led by Austin Bunn. It's this Sunday, February 11th, from 12:30 to 3:30 at the Fairfield Public Library. And you can call, if you want to pre-register, toll-free 1-800-888-966-6608. Austin will bring an extra instructor. And she's, Carol Oliker, the coordinator of this, is planning to make extra deviled eggs. So they have almost 20 people registered, which is a good group, but they would love to have more. And if you can't pre-register, if you find Sunday, that you're free at 12:30 to 3:30, just go right ahead to the, Fairfield Public Library. They'll be very glad to see you for this Writing Through Loss workshop.
Thank you. Now, Mom and I did something kind of special last night.
Yes, we did.
We went to Hancher Auditorium in Iowa City, and we saw the road tour of the producers.
Wow. Funny.
And this is particularly relevant to our guest today, Donna Colby. Now, before I get into Donna's background as a writer and an artist, I'll mention that her daughter, Adrienne Dollar, who has the same last name or same first name as my daughter, Adrienne, is studying musical theater in London, right?
Really? Oh, how wonderful.
So, hi, Donna. Welcome.
Hi. Good to be here.
Donna has published a couple of short stories, won a couple of awards for short story writing, and from that decided to launch into a novel. And before that, she had studied painting at the Rhode Island School of Design. So some of you may be familiar with Donna in the arts community here in Fairfield more than the writing community, because she's very active in the Icon art. What's that called exactly?
World.
The Icon art world.
Gallery, world, studio, everything.
And she's one of the hosts of the show, which is on KRUU.
Yeah, Icon Art Radio.
And that, when does that air?
That airs on Wednesday mornings at 8 o'clock.
Whoa.
So we're looking forward to when we can download shows and everybody can hear it whenever want to.
Yes. I know they're working on getting all these shows archived on the website.
That would be very nice.
It'll be a great thing. I do get a lot of requests for listening, you know, people who want to hear past shows. Mm-hmm. So we invited Donna to be on Writer's Voices because she has a very interesting topic, which is something that should be a lot of fun and that she has a lot of experience with, and that is writing in cafes. So, Donna, you know, there's a classic image of a writer in a cafe, and going way back, for hundreds of years. Well, maybe not hundreds, but at least 100 years. And I know we're going to get a little bit into the history.
Yeah, I got a little history
of how that developed. But do you think that most people, when they're writing in a cafe, actually, is it a productive place to write? Aren't there a lot of distractions?
That's
what everybody asks me all the time when they
first
see
question.
Me
uh-huh.
writing in a cafe. And, you know, and yes, there is kind of like a romantic image I always had as a writer before I traveled in Europe, you know, and tried it. The image of the literary cafe is pretty common. You see it in movies and all. And there are even, in some places, there are cafe proprietors who actually try to get writers to sort of hang out there because they think it gives them a different sort of ambiance than just the coffee shop feeling. But there are lots of people who do consider it sort of posing to write in a cafe. Like, you know, how could you actually be writing? Aren't you just trying to look cool? And
you're acting like a writer.
Pretend that you're a writer yeah. if you're here.
Yeah.
And I'm going to get into that a little bit later on in my own experience in writing. But just, you know, to go and follow up on this cafe image, there, I think, are some people who sort of do pose as writers in cafes because it's easier than just being there by themselves, drinking a cup of coffee. You know, if somebody goes to a cafe alone, if they take a journal or their laptop, they feel less self-conscious being there alone. So
oh,
I think
sure,
it comes
yeah.
in handy for that. But yeah, there are serious writers who actually find that there are good reasons for them to write in a cafe. And probably everybody knows about J.K. Rowling's story, who wrote the first Harry Potter book entirely in a cafe. And the reason why she did it was because she had a baby daughter who would not take naps at home, would only take a nap if she took her for a walk in a stroller. And so she would take her for a walk in a stroller, and as soon as the baby was asleep, she would dash into a cafe and sit at a table and write until the nap was over. So that's why she wrote Harry Potter.
And how long did it take her to finish the novel?
I don't know, actually, how long. But there is actually, I read recently that she's in preparing for the seventh Harry Potter book, she decided for some reason, it didn't say the reason, to go back and write in cafes again. Maybe it was just nostalgia, but she, and, you know, rumor has it that she's writing that in longhand as well.
I wondered if she, after the first book was published, if it was even possible for her to write in cafes anymore because she became so famous.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Everybody would know, oh,
right.
She's writing Harry Potter.
And they'd want her autograph. And but maybe sometimes when you're in a small town or a neighborhood environment, people will respect the privacy mm-hmm. of the celebrities that live there.
And, right. And too, you know, huge celebrity is sometimes intimidating anyway. You know, you may be people may be less apt to actually go up and
sure.
make a conversation
oh,
with
good
you.
Point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little scary.
Never been there.
Well, are there other advantages besides helping your baby sleep of writing in a cafe as opposed to writing at home?
Yeah. Well, for me, the advantage is that I'm not surrounded by all of the things calling me in my home, all the undone things surrounding me when I'm at home. And somehow at home, there are just like more options available. I'm not as focused on what I'm doing. And then there's another thing, like Natalie Goldberg, who everybody knows is like a writer, well-known writer, and she's written a lot of books about writing. She recommended writing in cafes because she said that the noise and bustle occupies the part of the brain that would normally be telling you your writing stinks and you'll never amount to anything. So she found that that was the case. She was less self-conscious in a cafe. And I think there's some truth. To me, there's some truth in that. I feel it kind of just because I'm surrounded by life and people coming and going, I'm less apt to take myself too seriously when I'm writing in a cafe. There are other advantages if a writer is a little bit more well-known. We just talked about J.K. Rowling, but a writer who is like either a really interesting character or who is famous will often be given free drinks or some other kind of perks by the cafe owner because it brings busy, you know, people will draw customers into the cafe if they know that's the place where that writer hangs out. And for the writer also, you find interesting characters in cafes. Mm-hmm. I remember one time when I was writing in this little cafe that I went to a lot in Paris, there was a woman who came in there very regularly. She was interesting looking anyway. You know, she had dark hair and dark, dark red lipstick and was always dressed in interesting kind of theatrical clothes. And one day she came in and she sat down at a little table in the corner with her glass of wine and she just started to softly cry. And the owner and everybody else in the cafe just kind of left her be, you know, and they'd every once in a while would bring her something. But it was respected that, you know, she was free to do that in this cafe. And everyone seemed
cool.
to feel comfortable about it. But I wrote her into my novel just because the character that I was writing about was in a cafe. And so I wrote this woman, and because I just thought she definitely added something that if I had imagined that, I probably would have thought, oh, that's, you know.
Unbelievable.
Nobody would
believe
this. But it was, it actually happened, and it was very interesting.
Did you ever find out anything about her story?
No, I didn't. I watched her regularly and scrutinized her to try to figure it out. But I think she was just a single woman who lived in the neighborhood, and this was her place where she hung out, like her family. Pardon me. And she, I think she just felt like this was a comfortable environment and she could be herself. Nobody seemed to try to hustle her or anything, you know, and she didn't seem to be wanting to meet anyone. It was, so she was an interesting character. There's another advantage, I think, of writing in a cafe in that, especially for somebody who lives alone, you get a kind of cafe family. The people who go there regularly, you feel, you know, then you have a little repartee maybe before you start writing, and it sort of warms you up. And so that's a nice thing. And I think another thing is that your senses are stimulated when you're in a cafe. You have the sounds and the smells and, you know, sometimes music. And Thomas Wolfe said he liked writing because of the intoxicating smells in the cafe.
Ooh.
Which are mixed.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask about that. That's something else, too, that would be helping people, I would think, helping your senses bring the whole thing together.
Yeah, and when you're writing fiction and you're dreaming up a scene, it sometimes stimulates your awareness of sensory images when you're surrounded by all of this.
Which can really add to your writing.
Yeah, it can really add to your writing. And another thing is a cafe can act as an office where journalists or someone can do interviews, let's say, or make an appointment with somebody that's less formal than if they came to your newspaper office or magazine office, and also just making contacts. And some people may even use it entirely as their office because for the rent price of one cup of coffee, you could spend hours there, you know, doing some negotiations with people. And it's also, I think cafes are a good source of gossip and news, and you can do a lot of eavesdropping and get interesting tidbits for your writing, too. And in the past, there were, you know, like 100 years ago in Paris, they didn't have, most people didn't get newspapers at home. They were poor, and so they relied on cafes for their source of news. And the cafes actually kept newspapers as well so that people could come there to read the newspapers.
Well, one thing I've noticed in Fairfield, we seem to be developing a kind of cafe society here, which is just, maybe it's been this way a long time, but I've really come to appreciate it more in the last couple of years, where you have the various cafes in town that have their regulars and that you can go to. And there's something very uplifting for me. I work a lot and I'm very, very busy, so I don't have a lot of time to hang out in cafes. And when I go, it's like I'm rewarding myself.
Yeah.
Now, writing can be very hard. You know, even if you love it, even if it's what you really want to do, it's definitely work. But by taking this work into an environment where you feel rewarded just by being there, it makes it more fun.
Yeah.
I certainly haven't done a lot of it, but the little bit of writing I've done in cafes just felt, and maybe it is posing and posturing in some way, oh, look at me, I'm writing in a cafe, but not for other people to see me. I'm actually
doing it for yourself.
Doing it for myself,
yes.
So in Europe, is there a lot of writing done in cafes?
Yes, there is, actually. And, well, of course, there was more in the past. And actually, the reason why there were a lot of writers, you know, the heyday of writers, of course, was in the early 20th century, writers in cafes, especially in Paris. And one reason was that a lot of these writers, as well as artists, lived in small, pretty horrible apartments that hardly had any heat or maybe even had no heat. And so they would come to the cafes because
it
was warm.
Yeah, logical.
And so, you know, that was definitely, for one cup of coffee, one glass of wine, one glass of beer, whatever they wanted, they could spend hours there. And also, like, they didn't have newspaper delivery, most of them, a lot of them didn't have telephones. And so if their friends wanted to reach them and they were always at a certain cafe, then their friends knew that that was where they could get messages to them. Or maybe they could even phone them there. The cafes themselves would have telephones. If they wanted to make a call, they could make it from the cafe. And another reason was that a lot of them didn't have hot water in their apartments, and the cafes' bathrooms had hot water. So they would actually wash up in the cafes.
All the comforts of home.
Yeah.
More than what you had at home.
It was definitely a home away from home. And they also met other writers. You know, you're not isolated. I find this the case. Another advantage of writing in cafes is you have a little friendly talk and exchange of ideas with other writers, so you mm-hmm. don't feel so isolated. And the other thing back then in the early 20th century is, again, because they were so poor, it was hard for them to find enough paper, and cafes would give them stationery. That was one of their policies, was if a customer wanted some stationery, they would give them paper to write on. So many writers would just rely on that source of paper.
It's hard for us today to imagine being so poor that you couldn't afford paper.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, once again, I suppose that the owner of the cafe figured, well, a little paper and bring four or five more customers mm-hmm. in to see this. And
yeah. Yes, and even if they were only ordering one drink, let's say, in Paris, for example, there's so much competition because there are so many cafes that they don't want to lose any customer. They want, and it's not like in America where you're hustled out. You know, they want to like do a fast turnover so they can get more customers.
Uh-huh.
In fact, what I found there was that they were actually insulted if you would go and kind of eat and run, because their thinking was, well, what was wrong with our place that you didn't want to spend more time here
really?
And enjoy our ambiance? And so I think there was that, too. They wanted to not just make money selling things in the cafe, but they wanted to create an atmosphere that would draw people, and people would really want to come there to spend a long time. And then also back then, editors and, you know, this was, of course, before the computer era, and editors and publishers would often come to the cafes to meet writers and to solicit material. From newspaper journals would do this, you know, editors of newspapers would do this, or also book editors would come and just, in an easy, efficient way, take a look at something somebody was working on and seeing if they were interested.
So it really was a main way of networking
and
advancing your career as a writer.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Donna Colby today on Writer's Voices. We're talking about writing in cafes, if you've just joined us. So Donna has lots of both historical information and personal
experience
on this subject. And it makes me want to just leave here and go get a cup of coffee somewhere. So Paris, you know, that seems to be one of the main locations for writing in cafes. And was it, you were talking a little bit about how that developed. Is it still true today?
Yeah, it is still true today. And it was, you know, I was talking a few minutes ago about the early 20th century, but I think a lot of people maybe are curious about when the whole cafe scene started in Paris originally, and it was about the middle of the 17th century.
Well, that long ago.
When it started, and the way that it started was that at that point they had bars and they had cabarets, but there was nothing in between. There were restaurants, bars, and cabarets, but the cabarets, at a certain point around the middle of the 17th century, started serving not just like wine and drinks like in a bar kind of setting, but also chocolate, coffee, tea, little snacks and things. And people absolutely loved that in the
cabarets. Now, what exactly was a cabaret?
They have shows. They have entertainment, you know, like a nightclub.
Oh,
the cabarets were like nightclubs.
Right.
So somebody, you know, got the idea that, well, why don't we have something like, we don't have to have the entertainment, we can just provide a place where people can come to talk to each other and have these snacks and other options than just alcohol or a big meal. So that was how it started. And it really served a need. They found that lots of people really just took to this. And sorry, I have this paper with some notes here, and I got the wrong one. So the first cafe in Paris was Le Procope, which is, it's still there, but it's pretty much been touristized since, you know, it's not authentic like some of them are. But it started in 1675, and it was opened by a Sicilian who was actually one of the people responsible for turning France into a coffee-drinking society. We think they always were, you know, but they actually weren't.
It came from Italy. From Italy.
And
and were cafes already in existence in Italy at that time, do you know?
I don't know, possibly. I don't really know that much about Italian history of cafes. Maybe somebody else can come in and talk about that sometime. But so in 1675 that started, and the cafe world really took on right from then, never really died out, but it really expanded and had its heyday between the two world wars. That was like the big, and partly that was because of Americans.
And who are some of the famous Americans?
Oh, well, there were, you know, Henry Miller and Hemingway, and I mean, there's just like a vast wealth, Josephine Baker, you know, vast wealth of people who went there. And one reason that they went there is because people were kind of disillusioned after the war. Gertrude Stein, I think it was the one who called them the lost generation, the young people who went to Paris, the expats in the 19, or at, right after World War I. And what they found in Paris was this, the exchange rate was fabulous then, so it was very cheap for them to live in Paris. And they just took up, you know, hanging out in the cafes. It was a world of people who would sympathize with them. Everybody had been through the ordeal of World War I, and it was a real camaraderie kind of thing that happened at that time.
Do you ever wish that you could go visit a 1920s Paris cafe?
I do. I do in movies. I do in works of art. I do in my imagination. But they may, you know, it may be better today and just go there. Because when you go to Paris today, you take your fantasy with you. Paris is a city that lends itself to being whatever you want it to be. And so I went, when the first time I went to Paris, I took that fantasy with me and actually found it because the sets are all there. There are many cafes there that really haven't changed since those days. And the purposely, you know, the owners have been very conscious of keeping the decor exactly like it was back then. And so it's actually wonderful to do that.
Did you ever write a story about writing in a cafe?
Well, my novel actually has several scenes taking place. I wrote a lot of it in a cafe in Paris because part of my novel is set in Paris. And so when I was there, I would go to this one cafe. It was in my neighborhood, and my neighborhood was one of the neighborhoods that Hemingway had lived in. And it was the neighborhood he lived in when he wrote A Movable Feast. So when we would read A Movable Feast while living in this apartment, it was so great because he would talk about walking up the street. It was like our street. And there's always plaques on the wall of so-and-so lived here. So one of the plaques on the wall of a Hemingway apartment was two doors away from the Descartes Brasserie, which was my main cafe I would go to. It was a neighborhood cafe. It wasn't touristy at all. I hardly ever saw any tourists in there. It was a place where university students would hang out. And interestingly, I noticed that it was quieter than most cafes where French university students would gather. And one day I noticed that there were a lot of people talking in sign language. And someone explained to me that there was a university for the deaf in that neighborhood, and this was their cafe of choice. And so there would, you know, they would be having flamboyant conversations, as the French do, all with their hands.
Oh, but that was something to see.
It was. It was wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
And I just have to tell the listening audience that Monica, just by chance, with her daughter, happened to come to Paris at the same time that I was going to be there last May, and she got to see I told her about the Descartes.
Yep, and our hotel was like just a few blocks away from there.
Yeah, just right.
That trip, there were so many kind of coincidences with Donna on that trip, because we had both lived here in Fairfield for many, many years. Donna's been here since 1983, except when she's off traveling the world. And I've been here more or less since 1973, at least in Southeast Iowa somewhere, and we had never met.
Yeah.
And then about, I don't know, 2 weeks before my trip to Paris, we were introduced by a mutual friend and found out we were going to be in Paris at the same time. We were both going to be with our daughters. Our daughters are both named Adrian.
Oh, it's getting spooky now.
Yeah, yeah. And I said to Monica, where are you staying? And she told me the hotel and the address. And I said, Monica, that's 3 blocks away from the apartment where I lived for 4 months. That's my neighborhood. So I actually went, and I had arrived there already like a week earlier, so I actually went to the train station and met Monica and her daughter. They were coming up from Spain.
Right.
And we went out to dinner at a place right across the street from the Descartes Brasserie.
Oh, that's
Remember
right.
That?
Yeah, that was a good dinner. Yeah. That was very good. And then we met up one other time while we were there.
Yeah.
And so it was, but Donna told us where to go, and we did go to the Descartes, and it was a morning, it was a cloudy morning, and it started to rain while we were in the cafe, and it seemed like everyone that came in there knew the proprietor other than us, so it was not a touristy place at all. It seemed very real.
Well, and this is remarkable, too. It had been a whole year before I had... since I had been there.
Mm-hmm.
And I had gone there every day pretty much for like 4 months, but it had been a whole year. The first time I went in there, he knew what I wanted to order.
Oh,
for a year, he remembered me.
No
the owner
kidding.
Remembered me and knew what I wanted.
Well,
I
since you went there every day, I guess that would be. But that's that's a long time to remember.
Did he ask you where you'd been?
I told him where I was. He didn't ask. I just told him I was great, you know, happy to be back, and unfortunately was only there for 2 weeks. But I did try to go there pretty regularly on that second trip, just out of loyalty.
Oh, yes. And did you, so you wrote there quite a lot.
I did. I wrote there. I had a certain afternoon slot. I had a morning routine where I painted in the apartment that I was staying in, and then in the afternoon I would go out and see museums, go for walks, you know, just do Paris in all the various ways you can do that. And then later in the afternoon, I would go to this cafe. And it was a good time because that was when the students all came in. There was a lot of nice atmosphere and people coming from work. And I would spend a couple of hours there writing longhand. I did not take a laptop on that trip or a camera. So everything was recorded in my journals, and the journals were too full for working on my novel, so I got a pile of French notebooks, which I dearly love, and wrote in those.
Is there something different about French notebooks?
Yes, even though it's lined paper and, you know, it has a spiral on it, there's something different about it. I don't know what different paper quality, different proportions. It was smaller than our normal spiral notebooks, but not as small as the little ones. It was like a perfect size, probably the golden mean or something in this notebook, because I got a lot of good writing done in those notebooks.
Wow. Now, this kind of, I was wondering as we were talking before, and this brought it up again, in Paris there were a lot of artists that were, I mean, the art community was thriving in about the same time as the writers in the after World War One, and actually in the 1800s too. But you don't hear that much about artists working in cafes, painters or drawers.
I think they did draw, and there were, you know, people like Toulouse-Lautrec, I think, and there are many sketches that Picasso did in cafes, but their paintings, I think it was just too messy. You know, the cafe proprietors probably didn't want paint dripping on their floors. They did come to the cafes to interact with the writers. There was a lot of overlap in the creative community with the artists and writers. And it's interesting, like I was very aware of the famous cafes when I was there. And I would generally just walk by them because they're loaded with tourists, of course, because they're people, everybody knows their names. But I did discover a few where even though they drew tourists, the proprietors were very, very conscious to keep it a place that Parisian artists and writers would still want to come to. And usually the way that it worked, I discovered, was that the tourists would tend to like to sit out on the sidewalk cafe.
Right.
Whereas there would be little back rooms where the locals would go. And so I would like to go and sit in the back rooms and watch the locals and be out of the tourist stream. And one of those cafes is called Le Select, and it's in Montparnasse. And it was actually the first cafe in the 1920s to stay open all night. So they drew a lot of the young people, you know, who didn't want to have to go home when the cafes closed.
Especially when they had no heat.
And when they had no heat, right. And
so, maybe no lights either or anything.
So it was a very popular cafe. There are all these stories about, like, Isadora Duncan had some famous fight in that cafe over something, you know, and it was one of the many cafes that Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir, who they, you know, just about every famous cafe you read about said, oh, they sat here at that table, so they got around and did cafe.
Do they have any plaques or anything of, you know, who might have been there?
Some cafes do. That one doesn't. But there are definitely some. There's one, I think it was the one called Le Dôme, that has lots of photographs and mm-hmm. plaques with mm-hmm. a long, long list of famous people who were there. But even up the Select, even in the 60s, like Allen Ginsberg was a person who came there and was a regular. And it had a wonderful atmosphere. I went there. I discovered that one on the last trip that I went to. And my daughter and I, we actually met another Fairfield, ex-Fairfield mother and daughter, Lynn Durham and her daughter Athena, who just coincidentally were also going to be there during that stretch. And they met us, and we had this wonderful cafe evening at Le Select. And some cafes, actually in the 1920s, were sort of like places where Americans could get bohemian lessons. You know, they would go there to just find out, well, how do you live this lifestyle, that romantic lifestyle that we've been reading about? And they also like to watch the eccentrics. Like, I might have even been in Le Select, but Anais Nin and Henry Miller and Lawrence Durrell liked to play chess. And so they would go and sit and play chess and, you know, just kind of like be characters. And the Americans would like to go and watch them, like a stage play almost.
Now, I'm assuming that you speak French.
I speak a little bit of French. I don't speak it fluently. But my trick when I was living there was every time I had to go, let's say, buy some clothing or something like that, I would memorize the exact sentences that I needed for that transaction and practice them and I had pretty good pronunciation, so when I would go in there and rattle off these sentences that I had memorized, they would, of course, start talking back to me in rapid French, and I didn't have any idea what in the world they were saying. So now I actually have just gotten French television here in Fairfield. You can get it through your satellite dish company, and so I'm able to listen to spoken French anytime I want, and that's helping my ear, because I'm going to go back there, I think, in May when I visit my daughter in England and spend a little and practice my hopefully a little bit better French.
So in the cafes then, I assume that the French people speak French and the tourists are speaking English, and do they interact with one another at all?
The whole etiquette thing is such that if you're a tourist and you make even a tiny attempt to speak French, they will treat you more nicely than if you just expect them to speak English.
And it doesn't have to be a very good attempt. I can right. attest to that.
Yeah.
Just the effort. Now, a lot of people have this image of Parisians as being snobs, and that if you don't speak French perfectly, they'll, you know, just ignore you. And I've had even people who said they had that experience. I didn't have that experience. I was very, felt very welcomed by anyone that I tried to speak with.
Yeah, I had the same experience. Yeah.
And it may have had something to do with being female. They might be more open to females than to men.
I think it more just has to do with your attitude, because if they see that you're really loving their country and their city, you have to realize how many wars have gone on in Europe and how small the countries are and how different the flavor is from one country to the next. And they very much take pride in their national cultural flavor. And somebody explained to me, a French person explained to me one time that one reason why the French don't like to have to speak English to the tourists is because they can't speak it perfectly. And to them, language is an art that ought to be spoken well. And so they don't want to have to speak bad English.
That's interesting.
So the part of it is just that, you know, their pride in their language. And also French used to be the universal international language, and then it was replaced by English. So that's a kind of sore point probably also. And the British and the French have this a bit of a
strong cultural
rivalry.
Oh, yeah, always, from way, way back.
You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Carolyn. I'm Monica Hadley with my mother, Carolyn Kilborn, and we're speaking today with Donna Colby, talking about writing in cafes.
Oh, I just spotted something here in my notes about the one that I mentioned before called Le Dôme, the one that has the brass plaques and the pictures of famous artists. It was so popular, and the decor was so interesting, that by 1929, that particular cafe had appeared in 50 books in 15 languages, and after 1929, it even kept multiplying. So it was I never went to that cafe. Now it's not the same at all as it used to be, except that the plaques and the pictures are there, but it's kind of a tourist attraction now. But
do you know what area it was
in? I think it's in Montparnasse, there were a few different areas, Latin Quarter, Montparnasse, Montmartre, that were kind of the main places that the writers and artists hung out. And there's actually a story about Grant Wood, our Iowa
guy. Really?
Wow.
Who
now everybody's probably heard of the Dumégot. It's a famous Saint-Germain-des-Prés area near the Seine, near Notre Dame. There's a lot of famous cafes, the Brasserie Lip, the La Fleur, and this one, the Dumégot. And many of the famous writers, almost all of them, were associated with that cafe at some time. But there's a story I came across about Grant Wood. He was there in 1926, and he had actually studied and painted in Europe on many occasions and trying to, you know, just get his art form in the way that he wanted it. And he was having a conversation with an American newspaper man from the Chicago Tribune, and he said that he was going to go back home to Iowa, and newspaper man said, why? How can you leave Paris to go back to Iowa? And Grant Wood said that everything he had realized that everything he had done up to that point was wrong, that all the landscapes that he had been painting in Europe had already been done by the French impressionists better than he possibly could. And he said what he had learned was that all he really knows is at home in Iowa. And he said, and this is a quote, he was going to go back home and paint those darn cows and barns and barnyards and cornfields and little red schoolhouses and all those pinched faces.
Oh, yes.
So he did. And he came back, and not long after that, in 1930, was when he had his American Gothic painting in the annual exhibition of the Chicago Art Institute and, you know, burst into fame. And another little tidbit this book has, it has a story in it, is his sister and his dentist were the two models for that painting.
I had read that before. Yeah.
Well,
that's probably the most famous painting in Iowa, don't you think?
Probably. One of the most common pieces of advice that writers get is write what you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But I could see that can apply to painters, too.
Painters as well,
paint
yeah.
what you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, because like you said, the people in Europe have already done Europe.
Yeah.
And his
yeah.
style, I can see why, so different than the Impressionists that, you know, Grant Wood's style, that perhaps he felt it wasn't going to be appreciated there either as much.
Maybe so. And he maybe was just homesick, too. Like, I love to go there, but I actually am ready to come home when it's time to come back to Iowa, because even though it's really... there's so much stimulation creatively in Paris, and it's so nice to, I love the French language and all that, but I don't communicate with friends as deeply as I do here in Fairfield, in my own language, in the town that I've lived in since 1983. And the other thing I realized when I came back last time was that I actually enjoy being in a place where it isn't all already done around you. Mm. All this culture, it's like any creative thing you want to find is already there. You can tap into it. But here we have to create it if we want it. And there's
right.
something inspiring about that
That's
to me.
True.
So
mm-hmm. That's true.
I liked it.
Now, the Grant Wood story came from a little book that you found. What's that
yes,
called?
Yes. In fact, anybody who really wants to hear all the stories of which famous writers and went to which cafes and what they did there, it's a little book, very small book. You could actually carry it in your travels with you, called Literary Cafes of Paris by Noelle Riley Fitch. It's a little paperback, and it's very fascinating. And in it, I gathered some other little anecdotal information, such as Josephine Baker would take her pet cheetah into the cafes.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, that sounds outrageous to us because normally we're not even allowed to take our dogs or cats in there. But it's very common, even today, in many cafes and restaurants all over Paris to have dogs not only under the table, and the proprietor will come and bring something for the dog to eat, but actually sitting on a chair. I have a drawing in my journal of a woman sitting there writing, and next to her is her fancy little white dog just sitting there upright in the chair next to her at the table.
That's interesting.
So that's, you know, a different culture. And then there's, like, a lot of great stories about Henry Miller, who was, like, a real character. And he was very poor when he lived in Paris, and he would entice people into giving him a meal or buying him drinks just for the pleasure of having a conversation with him and hearing his wild stories. And it worked. I mean, it definitely worked. And there was one journalist who wrote for the Chicago Tribune, and he had a column about bohemian life in Paris. And he discovered that Henry Miller knew the best gossip of anybody. So it was well worth the price of a meal for him to go and hang out for a while with Miller and get all the information he needed for his next column. And they even struck up a deal that when this journalist, for some reason, was, you know, had a hangover or somehow didn't feel like he, or a writer's block or something, and couldn't write the column, Miller would ghostwrite it for a little extra perks, you know, maybe a more expensive meal or something like that. So he knew how to play the cafe scene.
Well, there's that old saying that when you know some really interesting tidbit of news or you've had some great adventure that you can eat lunch on that for a month.
Right.
And maybe that's where this started.
Well, and eavesdropping in cafes, too. It's like, you know, he was one of the people, as many writers were, who got material for their books through eavesdropping and observation in cafes. And, you know, I'm one of them. Just, it definitely provides you with material.
Now, you have a favorite Henry Miller book that you told me about that was the only book that you took with you on this long journey.
Yes, when I went traveling for a year to many different countries and took only 15 pounds of luggage total, I thought, I need something to read, but I can only take one book with me. And what I chose was Henry Miller's travelogue of Greece called The Colossus of Marousi. And this is an interesting little Fairfield anecdote. A lot of you might know Michael Mescon, who was an English teacher at Maharshi School. I don't know if he still is, but he taught my kids. And he was walking down the street one day, and just before I went on this trip, and he's very literate, and I said to him, "Michael, I'm going on this trip, and I'm only taking one book with me. It's the best travelogue ever written." And without skipping a beat, he said, "Henry Miller, Colossus of Marousi." So it's a really good one.
So if you want to read that book, it is available at the Fairfield Public Library after I return it.
Yeah.
It will be available. So what's your experience now writing in Fairfield cafes?
It's just the same, I have to say. It's, you know, there may be, it's not as glamorous in the, you know, variety of the decor. They're the beauty of the old French architecture and interior design, it just can't be beat. I mean, you couldn't replicate it anywhere. It's just really wonderful. But as far as the atmosphere goes and the people, it's wonderful. I tend to go to Café Paradiso, but I go to the other places around town sometimes too. But in the mornings, most mornings, I go have my little routine, my café family, and it just, I find that when I don't do that, if for some reason I have to write at home, I don't take my laptop. I write longhand, and I do research and things like that at the cafe, and I do my computer part of the writing at home. And if for some reason I try to switch my routine around and do that in the morning, the day just doesn't start as energetically. Because there's something about going to the cafe and being surrounded by all this life all around me. And I think my style of writing, too, and my focus in my novel, it has to do with layers of life. And when I'm alone at home, there aren't as many layers of life around me. Mm-hmm. So when I'm in a cafe, even though I'm not paying much attention to what other people are doing, I feel that
energy.
You know, yeah, all around me, and the variety, and sometimes I can't. Sometimes you can't help but overhear somebody's entire conversation on the other side of the cafe. But that stimulus, it isn't really that I'm gathering material directly from the conversations I'm hearing. It's more just the atmosphere stokes
osmosis.
More kinds of, yeah.
Have you ever heard a particular turn of phrase that you ended up using in a dialogue in your book?
Well, I have written those turns of phrases in journal, you know, like you're supposed to keep a little notebook and jot them down, and I have never once used one of those that I've jotted down. So it's more on a different level but occasionally I will spot a character somewhere who I'll not exactly model in my book, but there'll be some characteristic like the tilt of the hat or, you know, some hand gesture or something like that that I'll incorporate into a character in my book. So that might. And I mainly write first drafts in cafes. I can't do editing, second drafts or fine editing in cafes. For there, I need silence. And so that part I tend to do at home.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Well, can you tell us something about your novel that you're working on?
Okay. My novel, the title is Rowena's House, and it basically explores the creative process in the lives of two main characters, an older woman who's a 58-year-old widow and a younger woman who is a painter, and she's 24 years old. Her name is Cassie, and the other one is Rowena. And the other theme is home and journey that weaves through the book. In a nutshell, I mean, there's like plot, but I think I would say that my book is mainly character-driven rather than plot-driven. And the plot grew out of the character's growth. I had a plot when I originally conceived of the story, but it changed. And I actually had an ending that I thought was essential. I thought this house that was in the title, Rowena's House, I thought the house was going to have to burn down in the end of the book for Rowena to make the kind of breakthrough that she needed to make in her life. And I grew to love the house in writing about it. I didn't want it to have to burn down, but I couldn't think of any other way until much later, when I was a couple of years after I started writing the book, and I was in Paris, and another character just like came in out of the blue one day into the story, and he was just a tourist in Paris, but he turned out to provide the little missing piece that allowed for another possible ending.
Oh.
And so I have another entirely different plot and story progression, but that also can change because I'm still in the first draft.
It's evolving. How many drafts do you think you'll have to do?
I think probably two full drafts and then fine-tuning. The third, I guess you would call that maybe the third draft, but I will do a lot of editing after the first draft.
So you'll do your own editing then?
Well, I will. In the end, I'll definitely have many trusted readers give me advice on it before I...
But your style is to write the whole first draft...
Yes.
Kind of straight through and then go back and edit.
I find otherwise it wastes a lot of time because sometimes a whole passage will entirely change and, you know, it doesn't make sense to me to fine-tune something if
that
I
you
may
not
be using
it.
That in the
right.
end.
Right, that makes sense. Well, Donna is going to read a piece from her novel in progress from Rowena's House, And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Donna Colby, Fairfield artist and writer. We've been talking about writing in cafes, and Donna's going to share with us something that she wrote in a cafe.
Yes, and this one, I tried to find a passage that actually took place in a cafe, and even the Café Descartes, because I had a few passages, but they didn't work as well out of context. So I chose a passage that takes place during the Paris part of the story, because it gives you more of a flavor of the sort of deep focus on the creative process that I'm exploring in this novel. This is a conversation between Cassie, who is this young painter, and a woman named Genevieve, who she actually met in the Café Descartes.
Ah, okay.
And it happened because I sort of wrote myself into the book, because I was writing about Cassie every day in this cafe. And one day I said, she always saw this writer over in the corner. And then I thought, oh, I'm going to turn that into a character. She's not based on me, but she is a writer who just also is an American visiting Paris. So Cassie has gone to Genevieve's apartment that she and her partner Frank are renting, just like Cassie and Rowena are renting an apartment. Cassie was distracted by the visual surprises in Genevieve and Frank's apartment, a place entirely different from the typically French flowery rooms that she and Rowena lived in. This place was modern. The walls were a salmon color, like the inside of a conch shell, the curtains a bold stripe of white and dark purple. A coat rack, like a bare winter tree, held a rhapsody of jackets, Genevieve's passion. But if she looked closely, Cassie could see that these furnishings were not expensive. Whoever owned this place had put together a look that would appeal to tourists who didn't want frou-frou. It was like a stage set, supported a fantasy, good for short term, not meant to last forever or tempt any dishonest renters to make off with the treasure. Sorry, I'm skipping a little portion here. But Cassie got to the point. Well, without going into too many details, it's too raw, Genevieve. I had a fling that I thought was way more than it was. I was swept away, and I'm trying to regain my footing. But it did something to me, and I can't just go back to where I was before. It made me see what happens to me when I want to create art and what goes wrong all the time. In a nutshell, there is a magic that seems to come at us like a roaring train out of a sandcastle. We never see it coming. That's what makes it magic. These things occur all the time, but when they do, I can't help but want to harness them somehow. It's not enough to watch them go by like we watch a storm and rainbow or a street performance. It's like what Frank wants to do, take that magic and give it more form, more reliability. But in doing that, is the magic itself lost? Or more important, can you even do it at all? The magic is in some essence that catches you unaware, and it fills you all the way up. But sometimes, even 10 minutes later, it's gone. You can barely recall it. I can't bear that, Genevieve. And I realize that's what I'm trying to do in my art, not lose those unasked-for waves of mystery and magic. It's an issue of possibility. Can I or can't I? And also an issue of morality. Is it right to want to do this? Somehow it feels as if maybe I'm trying to take a newborn infant and turn it into a puppet. Can these moments of a magical blend of life elements be twisted and ruined by my very desire to possess them, to give them form and show them to others who will probably not even feel the same thing I did? Genevieve sat quietly and took a deep breath. I may have said it differently, but I know the same feeling. For me, once I enter into even the admission of that desire, it becomes a tidal wave. In those moments, as soon as I do more than just receive it without thinking much about it, the longing inside me increases a thousandfold, for I see not only the wave of the initial experience, but all the layers and possibilities I hadn't first noticed. It goes on endlessly, the magic, as you called it. For example, the other day I was walking along the Rue de Seine. There was a gallery in which the artist had focused entirely on white fabric. Her paintings were large, and the fabric she depicted was twisted, wrinkled, draped, spread out, and arranged in myriad ways. Excuse me. The lighting varied, so the shadow colors were different. As a project, it was like Monet's haystacks or water lilies. And that idea, for me, of tuning into one simple thing, one ordinary thing, and experiencing it over and over and over again, day in and day out, is the only way I can imagine to deal with this longing. Yet if I try to do that, I always know and feel that there is a whole world of billions of other objects and aspects of life that I am neglecting in order to go deeply into that one thing. And, said Cassie, even if I chose one thing like that, I don't know if I'd ever get to a place where I felt like I'd express the wonder of it. Maybe I'd produce some awesome paintings, but there would always be an elusive something that I knew I was overlooking, or not knowing deeply enough, or maybe knowing clearly but not having the skill to express. A lot of it is patience, said Genevieve. Today you rarely hear of artists who spend a few years working on one painting, or who do 100 preliminary drawings. And yet, even in Picasso's day, that was normal, common. I think that, being in Paris, my attention span has lengthened. And back home, among people I know, I have an extraordinarily long attention span. Lately, though, I've recognized my impatience. Like you said, these magical experiences come to us unannounced. Maybe we're walking across Pont Neuf, and the clouds are rolling in. It's late afternoon. The sun shining out under the dark clouds are turning the buildings to gold, to rich cream. Then along the bridge comes a guitarist. He stops and opens his case, places it on the pavement, tunes his instrument, and begins to play. He is attempting a Django Reinhardt arrangement, and he's good. You look at his face. He's young and serious, with a shaggy crop of black hair. You are just getting lost in the music when a young woman walks by. She's wearing high red boots and a black and white striped sweater, and she hears the music and stops. You watch her face, and you see a crisscross of emotion. Nearby stands a tall man in a black coat, carrying a large bunch of leeks wrapped in a cone of brown paper. You have no idea why this whole scene moves you to tears. You pull out your journal, try to record it, but it seems like stupid words, clumsy adjectives, nothing of the miracle you're feeling. Later, though, maybe a few days later or a few weeks later, you read it again. Unbelievably, those awkward words on your page rekindle the entire feeling. No, it's different. There's a new element, the blend of then and now. For today, you have another dimension going on. Maybe this morning, during breakfast, you happen to see on TV a baby being born. Those images blended with the ones you wrote about, and the feeling multiplies. Not in that frustrating way brought about by longing, but in a new kind of way, like playing music all by yourself, and suddenly a couple of musicians appear and join you in wonderfully inventive harmony. Maybe that's what it's about, not trying to capture a moment with all its endlessly layered elements, but letting each moment be a seed, something you plant very simply and then tend it. You water it, but not too much. Give it attention, but not so much that it gets no sun or air around it, and you wait and see what happens. Maybe you don't. Am I running out of time?
Or? Just about. Okay. Another minute.
So, all right. Let me skip down then to the end of the passage. I'll skip this part in the middle. You're wanting to capture something and transfer it somewhere else, Cassie, from your heart to your canvas. But maybe that's not the process at all. Maybe it's more like music. The initial experience is simply the opening, the first chords and phrases through which the music reaches you. Then the act of your taking it in and letting it move through you and play in different ways is like the improvisational solos that give variations to the main theme. The painting then becomes the grand finale when the music reaches its conclusion and brings together the main theme. Art itself wants to be made. It won't let us turn away once we catch its wink and smile back.
Very nice.
Wow. I got to tell you, that does not sound like a first draft.
No, it doesn't.
It's a very extremely refined first draft.
Really?
Well, thank you, Donna, for joining us today. Do you have any parting words about writing in cafes?
Just try it if you haven't and see if you like it.
Fantastic. Well,
you can start by, if you'd like to think you might like to do that, on Sunday at the Fairfield Public Library, that Writing Through Loss, a lot of us have lost
a loved one
and friends and so forth, and it might be something really rewarding to try. That's at 12:30 to 3:30, Fairfield Public Library, this Sunday, February 11th.
And once again, we've gone right up to our last minute, and with a just really interesting conversation.
Really, yes,
great to be here.
Inspiring.
Been listening to Donna Colby, and Writers' Voices with Monica and Carolyn, and we have our final quote of the day.
Real friends are those who, when you've made a fool of yourself, don't feel you've done a permanent job of it. Goodbye.
Great.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.